the first of these 10 principles I call having a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing. So there's two concepts in here. One is openness and the other is attachment. And I'd like to talk about each one of them here. The problem for most people, it has been my experience, is that they have been raised to believe in what they can't do. And it's a very simple prospect to change that. Yet most people never do. And it's one of the reasons why people are not very good at attracting into their life what they would like to have, whatever it might be, at any level. And I'm talking about from the very highest levels of miracles and healings and attracting abundance into your life to getting a job, to having relationships, the right person show up in your life, anything that you put your you can put your thoughts on or your attention on. I suggest the reason that people don't get the things that they would like to have in their life is because of that very simple principle that they are putting their thoughts or their attention or their energy on what they can't have or what's impossible. And it's a very simple paradigm for me. In the scriptures, there's a line that says, as a man thinketh, so is he. As we think, so shall we be. What we think about is what we become, and so on. It's endless. Emerson's notion that the ancestor to every action is a thought, that everything began with a thought. I was thinking about that yesterday when I was out there on Pete's Path, somewhere out here in Arizona, running and just all by myself out there with the jackrabbits and so on. And it was getting towards sunset. And I looked out at all of the things that are here at this beautiful complex called Miraval and thinking, this was just an idea. All of this was just somebody had an idea. Let's put together a place where people can come and have a spiritual community and have an opportunity to get their lives in balance and to let's offer them an opportunity to have healing take place. Let's give them a place where they can meditate. Let's give them a place where they can get massages. Let's put in some tennis courts. Let's have some dance things. Let's throw in some horses over here and have a horse whisperer come out and talk. And somebody had to act upon that idea. And it's true of everything that you can think of in your life. Just look at what you're wearing on your feet right now. Somebody had to think about those shoes. Look at the chair that you're sitting on. Just wherever you are. Just gaze around and realize that it all started with an idea, with a thought. As St. Paul put it in the New Testament, that which is seen hath not come from that which doth appear. That is, the source of everything in the world is not in the world itself. It's in something invisible, something imaginary, something that is formless, something that has no boundaries. And that is the world of thought, the world of ideas. And if you can just accept that premise, that what you think about is what expands, then if your thoughts are on what you can't do, or if your thoughts are on what you dislike, or if your thoughts are on what always has been, or if your thoughts are on what other people expect of you, and even if you despise all of that, and even if you find a lot of fault with that, and if you're very angry about all of that, about the way things always are, or always have been, rather, or the way things used to be, if your energy and your thoughts are on those things that you dislike, then you will attract more of what you dislike into your life. And it's almost as if it's a law of the universe. And that highly functioning people, one of the things that I learned from one of my great mentors, Abraham Maslow, many, many years ago as a doctoral student, is that when someone comes to you and they're looking for help of any kind, never place more than a few moments' attention on the problem. Because if your thoughts are always on and what you're talking about is always on what is wrong and what the problem is, you will become an enabler to that person to continue to manifest more of what is wrong and the problem in their life. And that highly functioning people, self-actualizing people that Maslow called them, were people who didn't think about what is, not even what is. And just notice in your life, as you think about this principle above having a mind that is open to everything, think about how many people you run into every day whose thoughts are on the circumstances of their life and who talk about the circumstances of their life. This is what's wrong. This is what I don't have. This is something that I can't seem to get right. I keep having the wrong thing show up. We don't have any money. We don't have the right friends. I don't like the way my spouse treats me. My children are always this. Whatever. It's this endless inventory of things that people's minds are occupied with that are on what is. And if you want to know about self-actualization, you have to learn how to take your thoughts off of what is and onto what you intend to manifest with passion. You have to make that shift so that every time you are having a thought that is based upon the circumstances of your life, what always has been, what used to be, or whatever, you shift it. And you make the picture in your mind shift onto something that you intend to create or manifest into your life. So having a mind that is open to everything and attached to nothing is a mind. This came from a man who wrote back in the 10th century in the dialogues of Tilopa and his discourses. And he was a Vedantic scholar who lived in India over 1,000 years ago. And he suggested then in those discourses that a mind that is open to everything is one that has the potential for attracting everything into its life. And a person who doesn't have a mind that is open to everything will attract exactly what it is that they have their attention on. So one of the things that we have to do to create a mind that is open to everything is to look at what it is that we believe is not possible. And then, if you will, rewrite your agreement with reality. Literally rewrite it. And have it shift. And I want to tell you a couple of stories, but before I do and give some examples of this, I'd like to read something that was sent to me a few years ago. And I have never been able to get this story out of my mind. It's called, "Can I Have Your Attention, Please?" A young and successful executive was traveling down a neighborhood street, going a bit too fast in his brand new Jaguar. He was watching for kids darting out from between parked cars and slowed down when he thought he saw something. As his car passed, no children appeared. Instead, a brick smashed into the Jag's side door. He slammed on his brakes, jumped out of the car, and ran back to the spot where the brick had been thrown. Grabbing some kid, he pushed him up against a parked car, asking, "What was that all about, and who are you? Just what the heck are you doing?" And building up a head of steam, he went on, "That's a brand new car, and that brick you threw is going to cost a lot of money. Why did you do that?" "Please, mister, please, I'm sorry. I didn't know what else to do," pleaded the youngster. "I threw the brick because no one else would stop." Tears were dripping down the boy's chin as he pointed around the parked car. "It's my brother," he said. "He's rolled off the curb and fell out of his wheelchair, and I can't lift him up." Sobbing, the boy asked the executive, "Would you please help me get him back into his wheelchair? He's hurt, and he's too heavy for me." Moved beyond words, the driver tried to swallow the rapidly welling lump in his throat. He lifted the young man back into the wheelchair and took out his handkerchief and wiped the scrapes and cuts, checking to see that everything was going to be okay. "Thank you," the grateful child said to him. The man then watched the little boy push his brother down the sidewalk toward the home. It was a long walk back to his Jaguar, a long, slow walk. He never did repair the side door. He kept the dent to remind him not to go through life so fast that someone has to throw a brick to get your attention. What a great story. And it's a true story. And it's reflective of having a mind that isn't closed. And that's really what this first principle is about, is opening up a closed mind. A closed mind to the potential of what is possible for you. One of the things, I read a book a few years ago by a woman named Tasha Abelar, and it was called The Sorcerer's Crossing. And it was a book written by a woman for women about learning to become sorcerers. But not sorcerers in the sense of witches, but in the true sense of the word sorcerer, which means of the source. Moving into that level that Carlos Castaneda called impeccability. And I was having a conversation with a dear close friend of mine who's here in the audience named Sally. And she was telling me in this conversation about being a young girl and being able to move into the future, or see the future, isn't that how you put it, to see the future? And how she would, and she got real excited about saying that she could make a leap from being a child into adulthood. And in that moment of leap, she could actually see the future. We went to the bookstore right from there. We were talking about it at dinner. And after dinner, I started to tell her about this, and I went and tried to find the book, and the bookstore didn't have a copy, but I've ordered it so that she would get it. I haven't read it in quite a few years. But one of the things that Tasha Abelar spoke about was this this thing called recapitulation. And it's a weird idea, but you almost have to be able to accept weird ideas if you want to have a mind that's open to everything. You have to accept that there's an awful lot of people who instantly shut out any concept that is foreign to what it is that they have been conditioned to believe in. And that's really what I'm attempting to have you look at here, is to just wipe it all out. Just clean your slate, if you will, from all of the things that you've been conditioned to believe that you can't, that are impossible. And I was reading about this concept of recapitulation. I immediately got excited about trying it. Now, with recapitulation, what you do is you move your head. I'm not going to go through all the details of it, but I practiced it for several months. And it's a way of sort of clearing out all of the trash that's in there and opening yourself up to higher levels of impeccability so that higher frequencies and faster frequencies can begin to show up. And you can begin to do some of the things that we think of as only available for masters or divine spirits or spiritually ascended avatars and not us. Even though it clearly says in the scriptures, Jesus certainly said that even the least among you can do all that I have done and even greater things. And I've heard some of the great masters in India reflect that the only reason I can do the things I do and you can't do the things that you can't do is because I know that I can. And you know that you can't. And you're convinced that you can't, and therefore you act upon what you're convinced of, rather than acting upon that which you're not convinced of. And the interesting thing about this is that every one of you listening here had a period of time in your life in which you believed you could do anything. You showed up with this incredible, optimistic, almost absurd belief that you could do anything. Just happened to see on the TV screen the other day a movie called Radio Flyer. It was about some little boys, and the Radio Flyer was the name that was on the red wagon, remember? And these two little kids were just convinced that they were going to fly and build an airplane, and they were going to do it, and their parents, of course, went crazy and so on. But while I was watching that, I thought I could remember myself back in Mount Clemens, Michigan, sitting there in my little wagon, which was the only toy that I had back there. And I had a red wagon, and my brother Dave had a red scooter. And he would go around on his scooter pretending that he could fly. And my Radio Flyer wagon was going to be the thing that we were going to sit in. And we used to talk like that and have these visions of being able to do that. And then, slowly but gradually, we grow up. And we begin to realize that all of these things are impossible. And we really can't build machines that can fly. And we can't create for ourselves the kind of life that we would like to have. Natasha Abelard was training her students in The Sorcerer's Crossing to be able to move their head from left to right, from left to right, and make a swinging kind of motion with their head. And when they would do that, you could then go back in time in your life, and you could recall virtually, not virtually, literally, every single incident, every conversation, every person that was in a particular room at a particular time. And you started out with, say, age as far back as you could think, say 3 years of age. And you would sit there alone in a cave, and you would move your head slowly, very slowly, from left to right, and you'd begin to recapitulate, and you'd go back, and you would be training your mind to go back and recall those. So you're getting the capacity of your brain, which has become dysfunctional because we've let and allowed everyone else out there to think for us. And we've been sort of pigeonholed into this is where you fit in, and this is what you can do, and this is what's possible, and this is what's not possible. And we bought into all of these pigeonholes. And she's trying to train people not to do that. And so I decided to try it. And I went back to the third grade. I started with the third grade. And I was in this school. It was Arthur Elementary School. And I thought, okay, I remember the teacher's name. Her main name was Mrs. Ingalls. And she used to read to us The Secret Garden if we were good. And she would withhold the reading of The Secret Garden at the end of the day if the class was bad. And I loved hearing The Secret Garden so much that I would be out there kicking ass for anybody who would start talking or doing bad things, because I wanted to hear my last 40 minutes of the day, because she could just read and make it all come alive and so on. And I decided to go back to that classroom for some reason, and I went to a cave. And, of course, everybody just thought that I was crazy, but that's the interesting thing about turning 60 for me. Is that I used to think that it didn't matter whether people thought I was crazy, and I used to even talk like that, but I still would read my reviews, you know, and I still would get a little bit concerned about it. Now I really don't care. And I went into a particular spot, and I would sit there, and I would go back to that classroom on a particular day. And you know what this all became so very vivid for me is that I remember when my grandmother was dying. She was 95 years old, and she was, they said, hallucinating. And a lot of people around my grandma said that she was, she had Alzheimer's or something, but whenever I would walk in to come and visit her and I'd go into the room, she never acted crazy, ever. And I just never expected her to. I just always had an expectation that she was brilliant and fun and great, and she would do all kinds of strange things around others, but somehow, for some reason, when I walked in there, and I had been helping to support my grandmother secretly for the last 3 or 4 years of her life, without telling anybody else, because I didn't want my other family members to be thinking that it was something that they had to do. And I think that had something to do with my grandmother's respect for me. She always liked money. And great lady. And anyway, then when she would lose it a little bit, and she'd start talking, and she just sort of was talking in ways that just seemed very strange, she would start talking about something that happened in the 1895. And she'd say, then she'd come up with, and she, you know, you'd look it back or whatever date it was, she was only three. And then she would say it was a Tuesday, and it was the 14th of April or something, and it was 1895, and she'd start reciting stuff, and I said, well, how could she know it was a Tuesday in 1895? It's almost 100 years ago. How could... And I went back and found a calendar to look this thing up, and sure enough, it was a Tuesday. And she had the name of the street, and she had the and it was all in there. Have you ever thought of that? That everything that you've ever experienced, every conversation you've ever had, every person that you've ever met in your life, that every single interaction you've ever had is all in there, and it's not, it hasn't gone anyplace. You can access it, you can negotiate the presence of that and relive it and have it there. And there's all kinds of potentials. I mean, Deepak Chopra and I talk very often about how weird it must have been. You ever think about what it would be like if George Washington came back and was here and would see all of the things that that are here, and the cars and the fax machines and so on? And Deepak and I were talking one day, and he said, just imagine what it's going to be like for people in the future. Imagine fax machines that you can step into. And fax yourself to the 14th century. And, that time is not something that exists at all. If you look at quantum physics, you got to have a mind that's open to that. Because if we had a closed mind, a mind that is opened, that is closed, we would have one recipe. take one whole moose. Put it on a spit and turn it, and that'd be what we would all still be eating today. Whole moose is cooked on a spit. Somebody had the idea of, let's cut it up a little bit and let's saute it and let's throw in a little. And it's like all of the things that we take for granted that are part of the great variety of our life and all of these wonderful modern things all came about because of people who had a mind that was open to everything. And when I went back and began to recapitulate and just see what was in there, see if there was a possibility that I could do what it was that she was talking about and training these people to open their minds up to the potential for what they have and what they can create. And I started getting good at it, and I would recapitulate for an hour. I'd move my head from left to right very slowly. Very slowly. And as I would do, I would let a thought come in, and I would let the vision of that school, and I would see myself getting dressed in the morning, and I could see the shoes that I was wearing. I could see where there was a little hole on one side of the shoes. I could see the color of the pants that I was wearing. As I was doing this recapitulation, I could see the jacket that was my favorite jacket that I wore, and I could see myself walking down the street. Then as I would walk down the street, I would see if I could recall the addresses and who lived in what house. And we're talking going back 50 years, and it was all there. Every house would be there. And after an hour or two of doing this, it became so clear, it was almost addicting. Then I'd get into the classroom, and there would be Mrs. Ingalls, and she'd be sitting up there. And I remembered where I sat, and then I'd go through this to the left, to the right. And there to my left, right across the aisle from me, was Fred Green. I said, Fred Green? Where does Fred Green come from? I never even recalled that name in over 50 years. And sure enough, I could see what he was wearing. And I could see the conversations. And then there was Erlene. And then there was, I went through all of the different people in the room. And it was all there. And it was all through this process of something called recapitulation. And I'm not really talking here about encouraging you to do recapitulation, although it's a great and wonderful experience to have, to start to open your mind up to what is there. What I'm suggesting is that anybody says anything to you, like, what do you think about reincarnation? Oh, I don't believe in reincarnation at all. It says right clearly over here in this, but in the Bible, or it says over there that I've been told that I can't believe in reincarnation. And a whole bunch of people got together in the 4th century and said, we will not have any discussion of reincarnation. And I have bought into reincarnation and as being an impossibility. I always loved what Eleanor Roosevelt said when they asked her about reincarnation. She said, I don't think it would be any more bizarre for me to show up in another lifetime than it was for me to show up in this one. Now, that was her reaction to it. So when I hear about things like, and I've never had an experience, as I mentioned in the opening, I've never had any experiences with past lives, but I read Brian Weiss's Many Lives, Many Masters, and I was fascinated by that whole idea. And I began to try to see if I could learn more about that idea. My own mother, who is almost 86 years old, has had for the past several months a severe problem with back pain. Very bad in her lower back, particularly, and to the point where she can hardly get out of bed, and even when she does, she's in pain. So after hearing her talk about it every day, and calling her wherever I am on the road or when I'm home being with her, and seeing the agony that she was in, I went to the bookstore and I bought a copy of a book by a man named John Sarno, S-A-R-N-O, who's a medical doctor up in the Northeast. I think it's in New Jersey. And I had had the occasion of listening to an interview that he had done. And I used to play tennis on hard courts on a regular basis. And at the end of two or three sets of tennis on a hard court, I would feel and experience some great back pain. And I heard this man interviewed on the radio, and he had a book called Healing Back Pain. And he talked about a weird idea that all pain comes from the brain, which isn't so strange, and that back pain is really registered in the brain, but that it is something that originates with something called rage of some kind that we have within us, and that our brains can be talked to. And I love the idea. This is a medical doctor talking to us about talking to your brain and telling your brain to forget the pain. I do not remember the pain. I do not remember the pain. And whatever I have any rage about inside of me of any kind, going back as far, who knows? I mean, my mother still hasn't forgiven my father, her first husband, for the way that he treated her, and he's been dead for 40 years, and she would have been married 67 years or something to this man if he were still alive, and she's still angry. She's still got some anger in there, and she admits to it. You know, she always says to me, it's easy for you to forgive him, but I was married to that asshole, you know, and that's very different, and whatever, all right? So I told her, I went and bought this book, and because I went and bought it after I'd heard this interview, because to me, I just liked a guy talking weirdly about how to get rid of back pain, and that you don't have to go and have surgery, and you don't have to, and that it's normal to have certain things showing up in your back, and all of these things as you get older, and all of these disc problems and all of that, that most of it can be dealt with if you begin to train your brain to not remember the pain. Falls mainly on the plane. I like this. I'm feeling like Henry Higgins in here. So I bought the book for her, because when after I read the book, I've never had back pain again. It just stopped. I continued playing tennis, and I have little tiny spasms of it once in a while, but basically back pain disappeared from my life after reading this book, and the energy of the book, or whatever it was, and I began to stop thinking rageful thoughts and so on, and began to whatever. And it was, so I handed her the book, and I said, Mom, I said, I want you to read this book, but I want, and it's very weird, because I'm always giving her something strange to think about, or something, you know, she just says, Wayne, you're so gullible, you know, just anything that comes along, right away you're trying it. You try this vitamin, or you'll try that, take this, drink this shake, or try that, and I said, I'm open to it all, you know. As I said, if someone's telling me that crystals will heal my hemorrhoids, I'm buying crystal chairs. You know, I'm willing. I'm willing to sit on it. All right. So I said, but the only condition, and I said, and I've been hearing you complain for 2 months about your back pain, and you've been to the doctors and they can't find anything, and blah blah blah. I said, just read this book with an open mind. With an open mind. And she agreed to do that. And I said, don't judge it. Don't get angry at it. Don't find fault with it. Just read it with an open mind. And she read the book, and she called me about, let's see, I was out on the West Coast, and she lives in Florida. And she called, and she, for the first time, had, I could tell, a smile on her face. And she said, you're never going to believe what happened. She said, I woke up this morning, and I didn't have any pain. I just absolutely didn't have it. And I talked to my brain, and I told my brain, you've got to stop remembering the pain. Forget the pain. And she said, and I've been very angry because some things had happened in my family that she was all upset about and she was hurt about. And she said, I let go of it, and her back pain was gone. Now, it came back a little bit a couple of days later, but then she began to do it again. And she's free of back pain. A mind that is open to everything. A mind that is open to everything is a mind that invites in miracles. I wrote a book called There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. On the cover of that book, there's a photograph. And that photograph has energy in it. And that photograph is something that I'm about to hold in my hand right now, the cover of that book. And it took place in Assisi. And I was there with a group of people that I had taken over there. And I can't tell you how many people have picked up this book and told me that the energy of the cover itself is what it is that attracted them to the book. When Nisargadatta, a great teacher in India, finished a collection of writings called I Am That, he said, you don't have to read it. Carry it with you. Just carry it with you every day for a year. And the energy of the words inside will come to you through the process of energy transfer. And you'll begin to get what's in there just by carrying it around. Now, that's a strange idea. You can carry a book around. But people do it. People carry emblems around, and they carry little medals around, and they carry photographs around, and we're learning about the energy of photographs and so on. And this photo was snapped. It's a picture of me at a balcony on in a castle in Assisi after I had carried a young man who had muscular dystrophy up the steps of this castle on my back. And as I put him on my back, he couldn't go any further because his legs just couldn't negotiate the stairs, and he felt that he was going to collapse. And I said, John, just get on my back. His name's John Grable. And I put him on my back, and I carried him up the steps and ran to the top of the steps. Had energy like I'd never seen before, and I had a very bad knee and a bad leg. At that time, then I'd had to wear a brace when I ran and played tennis, and people had told me that I had to have arthroscopic surgery and so on. And when I got to the top of at the balcony up there, all of the people said, what happened? And I said, as my knee was about to collapse, I saw a vision of St. Francis of Assisi, whom I had been teaching on this particular trip. And my knee just righted itself, and I had the most incredible burst of energy I'd ever had before in my life. And I got up to the top of that, and my leg just didn't hurt at all anymore. And I used to walk with a limp with this leg and was preparing to have surgery at some time down the road to heal it. And they were even talking about replacements and all of that. And I walked out to the balcony, and I put my hands together, and there was a woman on the trip. Her name was Pat Egan, who was taking photographs everywhere. And she took a photograph of me with my hands together in a moment of prayer, giving thanks to Francesco, the man for whom San Francisco was named, St. Francis. And she snapped that picture, and it became the cover of this book, Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. And a miracle had taken place. And you know why? Because I've always been open to the idea of miracles, of spontaneous healings, of the capacity for anything to happen, because the law that has allowed any miracle to ever take place since the beginning of time is still on the books. And if it can happen for anyone, it can happen to anyone. As Michelangelo put it, one of the people who had an open mind, the greater danger is not that our hopes are too high and we fail to reach them. It's that they are too low and we do. And having high hopes isn't just a song that Frank Sinatra sang with a bunch of little kiddies. Anyone watch that ant can't, remember that? Make a rubber cheap plant, cause he's got what? High hopes, he's got high hopes. I love that. Got all the little kids giggling in the background and so on. You remember that recording? Just recapitulate. Frank Sinatra, Frank, left to right. A mind that is open to everything says that the same force that has allowed anything to ever take place is in me. And if it has ever happened for any human being, it has the potential for happening to me. I can't tell you how many people told me when I was a little boy how absurd it was to believe that I would someday be famous. And how people just would say, oh, Wayne, come on, get a grip. Those kinds of things don't happen to you, and so on. And that I would be able to write, and that I would be able to create the kind of the energy to have books appear on bestseller lists and to be able to attract. And still to this day, when I feel something internally about what I would like to be able to do, no matter how absurd, no matter how silly, whatever it might be, I had a vision always of going to Machu Picchu and being at that particular place in the Andes that I had read about, which wasn't discovered until 1911 by the West, and was and I remember standing when I got to the top of Machu Picchu and standing at that mountain peak in the Andes and feeling the incredible power of that. I had taken four of my teenage daughters with me on that particular trip. And they were complaining and finding fault and bitching and moaning about everything. And I don't like this, and I'm the altitude is that. And every place we went, they were upset and they didn't like that. And I want to go with my friends, and I don't care, use my cell phone. You know, they don't have any. This doesn't work and that doesn't work. And we got to Machu Picchu, and they were completely different people. They were in a different energy field altogether. And they became loving and sweet. And they didn't want to leave, and they wanted to go out and meditate. And I want to go back there with them all the time now. They remember Machu Picchu, and they had a collection of those little, what do they call them, beanie babies? Yeah, they had about 300 of these things. We had put them in a big garbage plastic bag and taken them with us to Machu Picchu. And they were hoarding them, and they were upset that we were going to give, you know, that we might be giving them away, because we said there's little children there who've never seen such things. They started, you know, Dad, here, let's give one to this one over here. Oh, look at that little guy over there. Let's give him one. Oh, let's give that little girl. They became generous and kind and sweet, and not that they aren't always, but everything changed. And it's what I'm suggesting here. In this opening principle, is a mind that is open to everything and attached nowhere, is a mind that says, I'm listening. I'm listening. Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah, I'll consider that. Whatever it might be, no matter how absurd, no matter how ridiculous it might sound to you, I'm listening. I have the power to be able to do the things in a spiritual sense that I have been trained to believe are impossible for me. Things like synchronicity, into which I can find myself connected, that there's a collaboration I can have with fate, that I can make conscious contact with God, that I can access and negotiate the presence of an intelligence and an energy that I never considered was possible for me. If you can't think it, if you can't visualize it, if you can't get a picture of it in your mind, and the only picture you can get in your mind, the only energy that you're putting into your life is on what's impossible, is on what you can't do, is on what always has been, is on what everyone else has always told you, then regardless of whether you like it or not, you will continue to attract what you can't do, what always has been, what is, into your life. You have to make an incredible shift here and have an open mind and invite in the potentiality for virtually anything to show up in your life. The second part of this is the word attachment. Having a mind that is open to everything is one thing, but attached nowhere. And attachment, I wrote a book a few years ago called You'll See It When You Believe It, and there's an entire chapter in there called Detachment. And one of the things that Maslow said and taught us is that self-actualizing people are living their life detached from outcome. Detached from outcome. And detached from outcome means that I don't do what I do because of what might show up for me. I'm not motivated by being famous. I'm not motivated by making money. I'm not motivated by other people's approval. I'm motivated by doing what I love and loving what I do, which I'll be talking about in the second principle. And it's the process of doing it and living it and loving it that appeals the most. And it's very difficult in a world which says that you are what you have, and you are what you do, and you are your accomplishments and your achievements and your acquisitions, when you begin to evaluate yourself on the basis of all of these kinds of things, then attracting those kinds of things becomes the almost paramount motivator of our lives. But to shift away from that, to understand what Thoreau wrote about back there in Concord, Massachusetts, at Walden Pond, when he defined success as advancing confidently in the direction of your own dreams and endeavoring to live the life which you have imagined, then you will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. And it's one of the most difficult things in Western civilization to get people to understand is that doing what you love and loving what you do is its own reward, and that whatever the universe provides for you in the way of outcome is what you accept. It's fine. So that what you are motivated by is a sense of peace and fulfillment and awareness that I'm doing what I love and loving what I do. And one of the places where attachment shows up most profoundly is in our relationships. That we begin to believe that who we are and our happiness is based upon another person or my family. And there's a wonderful writer who passed away a few years back. His name was Anthony DeMello. And he was he lived in India, and he was a Catholic priest. And if you ever heard any of his tapes or read any of his books, he's very, very entertaining, tells great stories. I recommend that you get to know him, Anthony DeMello, D-E-M-E-L-L-O, and read some of his books and read some of the stories and even hear some of his tapes. He's a wonderful speaker, brilliant man. He wrote a book called The Way to Love, a little book. You can carry it around in your pocket, literally that small. You can carry it in your back pocket, The Way to Love. And he suggests most of his life was about trying to teach his patients and parishioners and people who would listen to him about attachment. He said the source of all unhappiness in the world is attachment. That if you could learn to detach, and I recommend that you read you'll see it when you believe it, that chapter on detachment, because it sort of wrote itself through me. And I practice, have to work at practicing it all the time, having as many children as I have, to understand that I am not the source of their happiness and that they are not the source of mine. And sometimes it sounds almost callous, but this is what he suggests in The Way to Love that'll help you to experience love in a non-attached way. How do you love someone and not be attached to them? And attachment means that I become immobilized if I don't get what it is that I'm seeking. Attachment doesn't mean that I'm not attracted to you, that I don't love you, that I'm not happy with you, that I don't love things. Detachment is about understanding that if what you would like to have from another person is not available, then you don't become immobilized. And he says, here are two tests. First, can you say this to other people in a detached way? I am not really attached to you at all. I am merely deluding myself into the belief that without you, I will not be happy. Can you be in a relationship with anyone, including your own children and family, and be able to say to them that I am deluding myself into the belief that without you, I will not be happy? And the second is, this is the toughest one, I think, of all. One that I've met very few people who are in relationships, love relationships, spousal relationships, and so on, who can pass this test. Be able to say to the person you love, I leave you free to be yourself, to think your thoughts, indulge your tastes, follow your inclinations, and behave in ways that you decide are to your liking. You have that freedom, and you have my love in the process. It's a great test, one that I have failed on many occasions in my life, but I'm working on. I haven't failed it so much with my children. Somehow I think the advantage I had in growing up in the way that I did in a series of foster homes until I was almost 10, and being required to go out and earn my way in life, not having someone hand it to me, somehow that gave me the ability to allow my children to be what they needed to be, because I don't think I'd be where I am in my life had someone else handed it to me. And I must say it's one of the great conflicts I've always experienced with my children, is how much do I give of the wonderful abundance that has showed up in my life, and how much do I withhold and allow them to create it for themselves. And I have found that most of the time when I give too much and take over for them and do it for them, that not only do they fall, but I find myself suffering more as well. And that when I allow them to figure out a way to create it for themselves, even if they get a little bit upset about it, that generally speaking, they're more at peace, and so am I in the end. So a mind that is open to everything and attached nowhere is a mind that says, I'm open, I'm listening, I'm willing to accept anything. I've never considered that point of view before. Tell me more. Wow, I'd like to hear about that experience. Maybe I can try that. I'll give that a shot. Yeah, that really appeals to me. I've always thought that that couldn't happen, but why should I believe that it can't? And when it comes to illnesses, and when it comes to the things that we think we have absolutely no control over, I'm open to the idea that anything is possible. And I'm not attached to the outcome, including my own happiness. Because as I said in a little novel that I wrote a few years back called Gifts from Icus, her parting message to everyone was, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. All right. Second principle is one of my very favorite things to talk about. Something I've observed over and over again. I think I got the first idea for it from reading a book by Leo Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Illich when I was in college. I call this principle, don't die with your music still in you. And I remember in Tolstoy's novel, Ivan Illich was on his deathbed. He had been an accountant in Moscow his entire life. He had been a commuter, what Jackson Browne in his music calls the pretender. Remember that song? Out into the cool of the evening strolls the pretender. He knows that all his hopes and dreams begin and end there. And the pretender is a song about someone who's chasing the legal tender and trying to get ahead by collecting as much money as he possibly can and going after wealth. But he's always a pretender. And Ivan Illich, as Leo Tolstoy's Ivan Illich, is also like that. And he's lying on his deathbed. And I remember reading this in my 20s and getting goosebumps as I listened to the end of the novel, where he's asking his wife, as he knows that he is dying, the question that just terrified me. He's saying, what if my whole life has been wrong? And I can't think of anything that just brings more terror to me than the idea of knowing that you're on your deathbed and you're asking yourself the question, what if I've been a pretender? What if all my hopes and dreams begin and end there? When I wrote Wisdom of the Ages, I picked 60 of the most profound and important teachers that ever came into my life. And the one thing that I observed about all of them, it seemed to me, is that not one of them got to the end of their life and died with their music still in them. And some of them died very young. John Keats, for example, one of the great poets of the 18th century, died at the age of 25. Considered by the Britannica to be the greatest poet of his generation. And he was only 25 when he died. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty. That's all you need to know on earth, and all there is to know. He wrote that when he was 22 years old, from Ode to a Grecian Urn. At any rate, this idea of not dying with your music still in you is really about an awareness that there is some kind of purpose. And that purpose to everything and to your life is not necessarily based upon something that we can figure out with our brain. Like, my purpose is to become an accountant, or my purpose is to find the perfect place to live, or the perfect mate. I don't think it's done that way. It's never, to me, an intellectual thing. It's always something that's of the heart. When I ask people to point to themselves, you know, they never point to their brain. They always point to their heart. And Gibran, the Lebanese poet, said that when you're born, your work is placed in your heart. There's something that you feel, and it's very hard to put it into words. In fact, I think it defies words, because words are just more symbols of something that we're trying to express. And it's the feeling that we have in here that I'm here, that I have a heroic mission of some kind, that there's something more to my life than just simply going through the motions and being a commuter and collecting a certain amount of stuff. So to me, not dying with your music still in you is what Maslow called the top of the pyramid. And you remember the pyramid of the self-actualization that begins with the baseline being the longest point. But the baseline is just taking care of basic needs. Like, you learn how to handle and provide for yourself. So you have to, at the very base of this pyramid, you have to feed yourself. And you have to have your needs for water, and your needs for food, and your needs for shelter as you move up this. And then your needs for sort of like companionship, and ultimately a need to feel a sense of belonging, a need to feel loved as you begin to move up this pyramid. Until you get to the very top, and at the very top of this pyramid, there's just a tiny little space up there. And this tiny little space at the top of the pyramid is what we call purpose, where you're living your life as if why you're here is really clear to you. A sense of purpose is not that I'm doing what I was told I was supposed to do that was programmed into me by somebody in the sky before I showed up here, but that I feel as if why I'm here is being actualized. And when people ask me about how do I get to that place of purpose in my life, I always remind them that your life is like what Joel Goldsmith called it, a parenthesis in eternity. So who you are, you know, Carl Jung referred over and over again, to the part of us that is eternal, the infinite part of us. He said the telling question of a person's life is their relationship to the infinite. And until you have that relationship with the infinite, you will not know anything about purpose. So that you almost have to learn how to step outside of yourself and begin to witness yourself from the perspective of who you are as not being this thing that you're observing. You go to the observer, and then you even get to watch the observer. And that's when it starts to get a little bit complicated. But as the observer or as the witness to the observer, you're sort of watching and noticing. But the sense of purpose comes from being that witness rather than what you are witnessing. And when you get to that place in your life, you begin to realize that who you are in this physical world, this name that you've been given and this body that you have, that you are occupying, is nothing more than a parenthesis in something called eternity. It opens parentheses at the moment of your conception. It closes parentheses at the moment of your death. But when you come into this parentheses, when you show up here, you show up with nothing, with no thing. And you go from nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, nowhere. And in one instant, conception, you're in now here. N-O-W-H-E-R-E. It's all the same. It's just a little question of spacing. Nowhere, now here. So now you're in now here. Hopefully, all of you listening are in now here. There may be some of you listening that are not now here. But while you're in now here, you have some kind of an awareness that you're going nowhere. You're going back to nowhere. So it's nowhere, open parentheses, now here, back to nowhere. It's all one. But there's something different about now here than nowhere. At least we think there is, but we don't have any real confirmation about that unless you're Brian Weiss. Or you know about past lives or future lives and so on. Now, one of the things that one of the great teachers in my life, Carlos Castaneda, whom I've referred to on many occasions, one of the things that he says is that the problem with humanity living at ordinary levels of awareness is that we are all beings who are going to die, but we act as if we're not. So that we don't really ever come in contact with our immortality or our infinity at all, because we are acting as if this body is all that there is and it's going to live forever. When in fact, there's an awareness in there that we're all going nowhere. And one of the things that a story that I told that I'm going to read for you that I put in a book called You'll See It When You Believe It, which was a turning point in my life, that book. It was the book that I wrote that made the shift for me complete from talking about psychology to moving into something called spirituality and higher consciousness. That was the shifting point in my life back in the 80s. You'll see it when you believe it. And I tell this story, and I'm going to read it to you. And it was a story that I heard told by a great teacher in India. A traveler from India went to Africa to acquire some local products and some animals. And while he was in the jungle, he saw thousands of these beautiful, multicolored talking parrots. And he decided to capture a talking parrot and take it back home and make it his pet. So now he's back home and he's got this talking parrot from Africa. At home, he kept his parrot in a cage, and he fed him wonderful seeds and honey. He played music for his pet, and generally, he treated him quite well. When it was time for the man to return to Africa 2 years later, he asked his parrot if there was any message he could deliver to the parrot's friends back in the jungle. Well, the parrot told his master to say that he was really very happy in his cage, and that he was enjoying each and every day, and to convey his love to his friends back in Africa. Well, the traveler went back to Africa. He delivered the message to all of the parrots in the jungle, and just as he finished his story, a parrot, with tears welling up in his eyes, fell over dead. The man was alarmed and decided that the parrot must have been very close to the parrot in the cage, and that was the reason for his sadness and his demise as well. So when the traveler returned to India, he told his pet what had happened. As he finished his story, his pet parrot, his eyes became all welled up with tears, and he keeled over and dropped dead in his cage. The man was astounded, but he figured that his pet had died from the despair of hearing of the death of his close friend back in the jungle. Well, the trader opened up the cage and tossed the dead bird outside onto the trash heap. And immediately, his pet parrot flew up to a branch on the tree outside. The trader said to him, "So you're not dead after all. You tricked me. Why did you do that?" Well, the parrot answered, "Because that bird back in Africa sent me a very important message." "Well, what was the message?" "He told me that if you want to escape from your cage, you must die while you're alive." And that's the story I heard from a great teacher of mine. And that's one of the things that I'd like to share with you here in this principle called "Don't Die with Your Music Still in You." You have to learn to die while you're still alive. And when you do that, what you do is you remove yourself from the identification of who you are with this open parenthesis, with now here. And you begin to see yourself as eternal, as infinite. And you have now let go of your attachments to all of this worldly stuff. And then you have this awareness, this realization, this aha. And the awareness is that I came in with nothing, no thing, and I'm going to return with no thing. I can't take one thing with me. And if I come into the world with nothing, and I leave this world with nothing, what can I do with my life? And the answer is, you can't have anything. You can't accumulate anything. You can't own anything. You don't get that privilege. It's an illusion that you might live under, but it will always bring you a sense of suffering. The only thing you can do with your life is give it away. And that's when you'll find purpose in your life. When you find a way to give away your life. Back to Francesco, St. Francis. "For it is in giving that we receive." It is in giving that we receive. Now, it doesn't mean necessarily making contributions. It doesn't mean giving stuff away. It's not about that. It's about finding a way to serve in some capacity. To me, that's what I believe Maslow was speaking about at the very top of the self-actualization. When you know that you are serving. See, when I went out and did those public television specials and I was able to raise $20 million and then another $7 or $8 or $9 million in just a few days. I kept getting wonderful accolade. You should see the wonderful letters I receive from all of the stations around the country. And almost always they are thanking me for making their pledge drive successful and for raising this much money or for raising that much money and for keeping their jobs and for keeping the station on the air and all of these kinds of things. And that's all wonderful. But there's a part of me that reads those letters and thinks and knows that none of it is about that for me. It's about we are now able to have this message go out on television in prime time in every market in the country. Imagine that. Imagine how many people are going to talk about these ideas and are going to share them with their children. And it's always about an awareness. And it's like I often say about, like, I didn't even write the book, Your Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. It just sort of wrote itself through me. And I feel so grand and great that I had a statue of St. Francis there with all the time, every day. I looked at that and I got inspiration from somehow the idea and the energy of this particular statue that I had taken, that someone had carved for me in Assisi, who went back 8 or 9 centuries in that lineage, and was a carver then and is a carver now. And I feel the connection whenever I look at that statue. And I feel so strong and so profound that I was able to have this come through me. And I thank Francesco for the inspiration. And I never take credit for it, but I take the royalties. I do. And I'm proud to take them, and I take them, and I distribute them, and I pass them out, and I enjoy them, and I make it a part of more giving and more enjoying and so on. But always there's that part of me that says, you're making a difference. You're making a difference. You are serving in some way. And I'd like to suggest to you that it doesn't have to be as public as it is for me. In fact, it was not always so public for me, for a good part of my life. I mean, I was 36 years old when Your Erroneous Zones became a bestseller and so on. So for 36 years before that, I was a school teacher and a college professor and a bag boy and a newspaper delivery boy and delivered pizzas and made hamburgers and things. There was always an element. There's an element of wanting to, giving is receiving. That when you receive, you want to give, and when they give, you want to receive. And there's this circle that is what purpose is about. And that's what your music is. And there are many people who equate what I'm saying with risk-taking. And I've had many people tell me how grateful they are that I've taken risks to talk about some of the things I speak about on tapes and on the media and so on. And I always respond to that with, there's nothing risky about it at all. The only risk for me is not talking about it, that I couldn't live with myself if I didn't. That when you are actualizing yourself, when you are finding a sense of purpose, when you are able to figure out a way to serve, and if you don't know how to do that, just ask yourself, how may I serve? It's the difference between asking what are my quotas and always going after what are my quotas. You know that Jung talked about the archetypes that we go through in our lives. You know, the archetype, the lowest archetype as adults is the archetype of the athlete. And the archetype of the athlete is the time in our adult life when our primary emphasis is on our body and what it can do and how strong it is and how beautiful it is and what it looks like. And then we move, he said, to the archetype of the warrior. And the warrior is the time in our adult life when we set goals for ourselves and we're trying to collect as much as we can and we want to defeat others and we want to be better than others. We want to be number one. They're all warriors. Everybody you see on television during the football games and so on, they've all got their finger. We're number one. No, we're number one. That's all warrior mentality. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's a very low level of consciousness and you'll never find purpose in being a warrior. Because as they say, you know, there's two ways to have the tallest building in town. One of the ways to have the tallest building in town is to go around and knock down everybody else's buildings. But as we've learned here, that particularly in America recently, we don't like it when people knock down our buildings. And if you go around knocking down other people's buildings as a way of elevating yourself, it's going to come back to haunt you in major, major ways, isn't it? Because the world's outrage will become apparent. But the other way to have the tallest building in town is to focus on your own building and to begin to work on it and make it grow and so on. So as warriors, most of the time we're knocking down other people's buildings we're trying to compete with. And then he said, you move to the archetype of the statesman or the stateswoman, which is the time in our adult life when we begin to say, what are your quotas, rather than here are mine. And how may I serve becomes much more important than what's in it for me. And ultimately we reach the highest archetype, what he called the archetype of the spirit, where you begin to understand what is meant in the scriptures by the idea that we are in this world, but we're not of this world. That's an interesting concept. You are not of this world. One of the things I had to do in some of my training was to imagine myself looking at Earth in a meditation without me on it, observing the planet with me gone. And my ego says, there's really no need for Earth without you on it. I mean, why do we need an Earth and all of this stuff that's out there if there's no Wayne Dyer? I mean, what's the point? But the part of you that is the higher part of you, the spirit, the part of you that I'm addressing here, the part of you that has music playing in you and wants to get it out, basically if you look behind what it means to want to get it out, it's about serving. For it is in giving that we receive. And it is in dying to self that we are born to eternal life while we're alive. Like the parrot, you have to somehow get the message. And if you want to get out of your cage, the cage of being imprisoned, the cage of having to live your life as a pretender, you have to die to self while you're alive and let go, as they say in the recovery movement, and let God. At any rate, at dinner last night, Jeffrey and his daughter, Jennifer, were talking, and she's a singer and a student at Berklee College of Music in Boston. And she has written some of her own songs, and she's going to school, but she really wants to be a singer, and she really wants to perform. And I talked to her last night. I said, so singing is really what you want to do? She said, well, yeah, that's all I've ever wanted to do. I said, then would you like to sing here? She said, well, we don't have a piano. I said, that's right, and we won't have one. Because I'm not using my powers of manifestation on a simple thing like a piano. You only get so many of those, and I don't want to use them up. I said, you either do it a cappella or you don't do it. And I said, would you like to sing for this group? And she said, yeah, I'd love to. I said, well, then why don't you think about that tonight? And why don't you come up here? Her name is Jennifer Autumn Knight. Come on up, Jennifer. And she's going to talk to you and sing a couple of songs, or one, or whatever you want to do. You got it, sweetheart.
Thanks, Wayne. I just want to say how blessed I am to be here at Miraville for this event with Wayne Dyer. And it's such a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And after meeting him last night, my life has changed forever. And he's been a part of my family's life for almost 20 years now, and has been a big influence on me the last couple years that I've taken the time to get to know his work and him as a person. And I just know that his spirit will always be with me, and I thought it would be really great to sing a song that I think all of you would be able to connect with and dedicate it to Wayne and all the spiritual awareness that he's brought us all today. It's a song that I wrote actually a couple years ago. It was one of the first songs that I ever wrote, and it's just kind of stuck with me all these years. It's called Don't Ask Why.
Don't run too far. You'll never find your way back to where you started from, spinning around in your circles. Keep your head up in the sky. Don't ask why. Take a look inside yourself. Don't ask why. You can hear your voice. Don't ask why, can you feel it in your heart? Don't ask why, the answer's been there all along. You stand breathless, all your energy see the light, I see the truth, I see the real you hiding deep down somewhere inside. Don't ask why, take a look inside yourself. Don't ask why, you can hear a voice. Don't ask why, can you feel it in your heart? Don't ask why, the answer's been there all along. Don't forget, everything comes to an end someday. What if that day was today? Are you happy now? 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 Are you happy
Thank you, Jennifer. That was so nice. Thank you. Boy, the words to that were right on to what we were talking about for this entire program. That was beautiful. Very nice. It's not as good as my... No, I won't go into it. So, when I speak about don't die with your music still in you, I'm suggesting that what you have, that you were born into, is a need to move in a direction of serving in your life. And as long as you are doing that, it doesn't make any difference about the details, because your job is not to say how. Your job is to say yes. Thank you. Thank you.